Case number 07-1336 et al. Public Service Electric and Gas Company et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Coretta for the petitioners, Ms. Paxella for the respondent, and Mr. Flynn for the intervener.
May it please the court, my name is Kenneth Coretta, and I'm appearing for the petitioners, the PSEG companies, in this matter. Your Honors, FERC adopted the reliability pricing model to value capacity so as to provide incentives for new entry to meet reliability standards in PJM, and to do so at the lowest cost to consumers over the long run. The PSEG companies have particular interest in RPM results because they were one of the areas in which reliability problems had begun to appear under the prior design. FERC erred, however, when it accepted a settlement agreement that included the so-called empirical cone or empirical cost of new entry mechanism. Because of this mechanism, this mechanism will undermine RPM's ability to achieve its goals.
Can I just step back a minute from this?
Yes,
I don't understand your brief to attack the initial cone computation and your attack on modifications under 205. I mean, it's at most indirect. There's a notice requirement. Okay, there's a notice requirement. So the question comes up in my mind, suppose the commission had done all this without any econ at all. Would there be a problem? Would there be an illegality?
If the question you're asking is, if the commission had adopted the RPM mechanism as originally proposed, which only had an administrative mechanism.
No, you're not taking the hypothetical, so I'm giving it to you. It's everything is as it is right here, except we don't have econ.
If we don't have ECON, then
what's unjust and unreasonable about it?
Because ECON essentially leads the cone value astray. If we only had the administrative mechanism, I think we would feel that RPM is the discomponent of RPM would be just and reasonable.
But the thought that ECON may take cone down.
It not only takes cone down, but as the April 4th, 2008 order makes clear, the failure to satisfy the ECON criteria becomes an obstacle to making an administrative adjustment.
I'm sorry, explain that to me.
Well, in the April... FERC...
Yeah, April 4, 2008, okay.
Yes, FERC sought to increase the CON value through an administrative... filing in early 2008.
The filing under 205.
That was a filing under 205.
Right.
And FERC and it generally was agreement that the cone value was understated by 40% to 50% in that case.
Yeah, but there's a notice requirement, and FERC enforces the notice.
It wasn't just a notice requirement, Your Honor. I think if you read
the stakeholders meeting,
there was a stakeholders meeting, right. But PJM argued essentially. There are two administrative cone adjustment mechanisms, which makes this confusing. There is one that has to have the notice prior to September 1st of a given year, and then there's one that PJM can make on 15 days notice at any time. PJM essentially argued for both of those. The court found, or the commission found, that it would be necessary in order to support an adjustment of an administrative adjustment of ECON that PJM would need to overcome, essentially the presumption created by ECON that there should not be a CONE increase.
Where do you see that? I mean, what I see, I'm looking particularly at paragraph 29 of the decision. PJM has not shown its filing. There's good cause for ignoring the existing tariff provisions, accepting PJM's proposal to increase CONE values, and then it turns to the notice issue.
Well, Your Honor, I think if you read elsewhere in the order, what you find is that there CONE or
where is that? Where is this in the order? There's not much left at this point. It's paragraph 30.
Essentially, and I'm trying to identify the paragraph, but the commission said that FERC would need to identify a reliability need in order to...
Yeah, for dispensing with the special notice requirements. Okay. So,
FERC never
if
found...
If you attack the notice requirements, I guess, as themselves unjust and reasonable, I guess I'd understand the claim, but you aren't making that claim.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at footnote 22, this relates to the retained Section 205 rights, which are the rights that the commission or that FERC retained, that PJM retained in order to make a Section 205 filing at any time it essentially deemed that it was needed to do so.
The footnote 22 seems to say, well, regardless of the special provisions of the tariff, there's always sort of a residual 205 right which couldn't have been compromised by the tariff.
It was expressly reserved in this case. The settlement agreement expressly provides that PJM retains the right to make a Section 205 filing. And in order to make
regardless of the notice requirements provided for in whatever it is, 510, whatever.
This was the 15. There are two administrative CONE adjustment mechanisms. This mechanism only requires 15 days notice to the stakeholders. FERC never made a finding that procedural requirement had not been met. It essentially just said we aren't even going to consider it because we found that PJM's proposal here is not just and reasonable. FERC never found a procedural bar to exercise of these retained Section 205 rights.
I see what you mean. But that, to be honest, it is odd.
Your Honor, I think if you look elsewhere in the order, and it might take a very careful reading of it, but FERC did consider in the order, it looked at whether the ECON criteria were satisfied or not. And in deciding that it would not allow an administrative adjustment, it definitely considered the fact that the ECON was saying one thing and the administrative CONE adjustment method was saying something else. The price setting mechanism in PJM basically has three main pieces to it. There's a supply curve based on capacity resource bids, a fixed downward sloping demand curve, and a mechanism to correlate the curve with the prices, and that is the function performed by the cost of new entry value. Really, the curve doesn't have any meaning and can't be evaluated unless it's correlated somehow with the price scale. So this is a crucial element of our RPM, and in fact, all of the modeling studies that were done by PJM's witness, Dr. Benjamin Hobbs, in support of RPM, assumed that this correlation would be maintained by having an accurate cone. So FERC seemed to recognize this in its orders, and
but
yes.
If I may go back.
Sure.
If cone is initially computed, was satisfactorily computed, and if there's a 205 mechanism slightly impaired by the notice requirement for modifying it, what more can you demand in terms of the statutory requirement that the rate be just and reasonable?
Your Honor, the cone, the RPM price setting mechanism assumes that the cone value will be accurate essentially at all times, even when there's an excess of supply.
It's exactly all times, because they,
well, you know, reasonably, I mean, reasonably,
even FERC can't,
yes, of course not.
Do things instantaneously.
But, well, the ECOM mechanism here, though, is designed to consider reference prices that are other than new entry bids. So it there is a deliberate choice here to do something contrary to the design.
Say that again.
The ECOM mechanism here uses as reference prices not just new entry bids, but it also considers bids by existing resources if they are the ones that
they clear the market.
Clear the market, correct.
Isn't, if they clear the market, isn't that
well,
an indication that no higher figure is necessary to attract the necessary supply?
Your Honor, that's not how RPM was designed to operate. Even during times when there's excess supply, it's important that the demand curve correlate with the price scale. I mean, if you're a developer of a new resource and you are going to want to recover your costs over a 20-year period, you are going to probably levelize those costs and think about what you're going to get over that 20-year period. If you're looking at a cone, if you're looking at a demand curve that is going to be correlated with cone throughout that 20-year period, that's a very different proposition if you're looking at a demand curve that at times will be correlated at a level well below the cone level, which could be based upon existing prices. So it's important that this correlation exists even at times when there's excess supply. And that's how Dr. Hobbs did his modeling. The ECON is also flawed in the sense that
among your arguments is the argument that ECON should be calculated on the basis of bids that are among the cone bids that are in excess of what's necessary to clear the market. And I have to say you lost me completely on that.
That is correct, Your Honor. There may well be a range of bids, and we aren't saying that there can't be outliers in a situation like that, bids that you wouldn't count because they don't seem to be valid bids. But the point—
Why should one even entertain considering them, I guess is my intuitive reaction.
They are bids by entities that are in the business of constructing units of this type, and therefore they reflect the best judgment of members of the industry as to what it costs to build this type of unit.
They may reflect a judgment as to the a number that could be obtained under a happy set of circumstances for them.
That's true, Your Honor, and that's why we included in our proposal the notion that the PJM MMU market monitor could establish criteria and examine those bids to determine which ones
that's
were valid
sort of
valid bids.
View that FERC wanted to get away from.
There is still an examination of new entry bids that occurs under RPM as it exists now, and by allowing all of these bids to be considered in setting the cone level, you would get much more information about what the marketplace thinks and the companies that actually do this kind of work than under FERC's proposal, which, as I said, will allow the cone value to be influenced by bids for existing units or maybe no units. There's also an administrative rule in RPM that clears the market when the supply curve clears underneath the demand curve. And so those prices would also be considered. The other major flaw we identified with ECON had to do with the fact that even when a adjustment is identified as being needed, the ECON moves very slowly. It moves at most one half of the distance between the calculated empirical cost of new entry and the current cone, or one tenth of the existing cone, whichever is less. And we showed in our pleadings, and this is not contradicted in the record anywhere, that to accomplish a 40% increase in cone, you would accomplish 92% of that over six years. So this is a lagging mechanism.
This is putting aside the opportunity to raise cone by a 205 filing.
Well, Your Honor, as we discussed earlier, there is an opportunity to raise cone by a 205 filing, but based upon the Commission's rationale in the April 4th, 2008 order, and further further taking into account what PJM said when it made its settlement filing, they would not make a 205 filing until a reliability problem had appeared. And by the time a reliability problem has shown itself, you've already probably had several years of price clears which are not consistent with the design of RPM. And when investors perceive that the market will be allowed to be cleared in this manner, that is going to influence whether or not they submit new entry bids. I think I'm out of time for now, so I'm going
to
sit down. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Pacella for the Commission. What the concern at issue in here at PJM was a reliability concern. And what the settlement created and what the Commission approved here was a system where there would be price signals without price volatility. And that's why built into the system was this, what petitioners are calling a delay, but what really is a prevention of price volatility that existed before. When there was a vertical demand curve, there was price volatility, and so the Commission approved a sloping demand curve instead.
I don't understand the petitioners to, maybe I've got it wrong, I don't understand them to attack the shift to a sloping
demand curve. No, they're not, Your Honor.
Demand curve.
My point is, though, and what the Commission explained here was that price volatility was a problem. So you can have price signals, but if there's price volatility, the price signals come and go. They disappear all the time. They change all the time. And so while the Commission wanted price signals, and the sloping demand curve created that, but if you are raising and lowering the level of the curve all the time, then you are cutting that back and you're creating price volatility. And the Commission specifically—
Could we step back a minute from it?
Sure.
You have a— it's not always called a demand curve. Sometimes it's called VVR, but often it's called a demand curve. And the demand curve is constructed out of the cost of supply. Now, that is an odd type of demand curve, at least a type of demand curve I've never seen before. So I just wonder why. I mean, it's the coherence of it is obscure to me.
Why it's called a demand curve? I don't know, honestly.
Well, I guess it's called a demand curve because that produces a nice graph, and then you have
right.
Looks like a market clearing price, except that what produced the market clearing price is not the intersection of supply and demand, but the intersection of supply and something else.
I think it is the intersection of supply and demand because you have the supply portion.
But I understand the supply portion, but the demand portion is not demand. It's the cost of supply computed in a different way from supply.
That's way above me, and I think if the sloping demand curve had been challenged here, I'd be much more up on talking about that, and I apologize that I'm not. But what I can talk about are a couple of things that PSEG has talked about this morning. I want to start with this Hobbs assumption that has been raised for the first time on appeal. And I know our brief did not point that out, but PSEG never raised in its rehearing request to the commission that Hobbs assumed that Cone would always be accurate, that it was accurate to start and it would always be accurate. And actually, quite the contrary is true. So if they had raised that to the commission, I think this would have been the commission's answer, no, you're not right about that. If you look, for example, at Hobbs' supplemental affidavit, which is at JA 1566 to 67, he specifically says, given that any estimate of Cone is uncertain and that generation technology is evolving, it's desirable to have a predictable and transparent procedure for changing the assumed Cone when bidding behavior and market clearing prices indicate that actual capacity costs may differ significantly from the assumed cost of entry. And then he goes on explaining about predictability and transparency is helpful because it promotes the forward market. It will, and the having this 10% cap is important because it will yield much less year-to-year variation than the situation without that, where the curve would be moving up and down all the time. And secondarily, it will still move over time towards the empirical cone number as long as there's a persistent change in the cost of new entry.
Where does FERC ever explicitly address the question of how using cleared bids of existing generators will accurately reflect the cost of a new entry?
What the commission said about the bids, Your Honor, Commission talked specifically about the cleared bids at paragraph 123 in the settlement order at JA 2638, and again at paragraph 122 in the first rehearing order at JA 2874 to 75. And what the commission said there was that the cost of new entry should be based on the cost of efficient entry. So just as Judge Williams was saying before, that the cleared price is an indication that no higher figure is necessary to attract needed supply. When the commission was talking about new entry, what it meant there was new entry into the market, that you had an increase in supply to the market. It didn't necessarily mean that it was new generation, because again, as I was talking about before, the commission's concern here was reliability.
Where did they say that?
Where did the commission say that? If you look, for example, at paragraph 1 in the settlement order, JA 2589, the commission says that it has to approve market designs and rate policies that elicit sufficient investment in energy, transmission, and demand response. It doesn't just want new entry in terms of increased capacity. It wants new entry, period. And new entry just means additional supply brought by transmission, demand response, or capacity itself. And so
capacity itself meaning what?
Capacity brought into the system.
Regular cone.
So this was not, even though what we're talking about in this case generally is about capacity, that was not the commission's whole goal. And it starts off the very first order challenge in this case in the very first paragraph talking about that. It again says the same type of thing in paragraph 6 of that order at JA 2592. It says, based on the evidence supplied by the parties, the settlement is expected to provide greater incentives for new generation, transmission, and demand response, while also providing sufficient
demand
revenue.
Demand response meaning what exactly?
Demand response is where instead of using what you would otherwise be entitled to, you choose not to use it, and you turn it back into the system. That, I have a pretty rudimentary understanding of that.
Supply coming from the customers.
Exactly.
Indirectly.
Exactly. So the commission was very clear what new entry meant. It wasn't the term of art new entry and cost of new entry like we're talking about. It's just new entry into supply that will provide energy to the system or capacity to the system. I want to talk a minute about this post-record case, and my first point is that this court, my understanding of the precedent is that this court does not consider agency decisions that are issued after challenged orders. Now, I'm not afraid of these orders. I'm only pointing
to figure out what the meaning of the orders
sure.
under review is, and it's pertinent to that.
I'm happy to talk about what that post-record order says, and what the commission held there was PJM came in and it didn't use just 205. It used the specific procedure where it had to give 4 months, and it said we didn't give this 4 months notice, and we're proposing a tariff change for this one time only so that we can be exempted from this one time notice. I wouldn't want to be defending that case before this court.
The filing that's resolved there proposed what exactly?
It proposed a tariff change, I believe section 17, which would allow PJM not to use the 4 month notice because they realized that they didn't do
simply directed to removing the notice.
For this one time only. And it said
for one time only.
For one time only. It was a one time only change. And that's if you look at paragraph 28, what that proposal again, this one time only proposal to change that. And then what the commission said was, first of all, you know, you didn't meet the deadline, and this is what you are telling us you're basing this on. You've come in and you realize that you didn't meet this deadline, and you haven't shown any good cause for not meeting this deadline. And then the commission also says that that PJM did not show again, paragraph 29 says, while PJM vaguely suggests a significant reliability concern motivates its filing, it provided no support for the claim. And on the other side, the buyer showed that there was no change warranted, that the most recent auction cleared within the equilibrium zone, and there was no need to change the
What does footnote 22 mean?
Footnote 22 means we haven't approved this provision under 205. It doesn't mean it's necessarily the 205 procedure. I don't think the commission actually decided that issue, whether the 205 right requires this four-month period or not. They didn't get to that. But what they said is that PJM didn't raise this other 205 way to go here. They suggested the idea.
Why isn't that raising?
Because they didn't put it in there. My understanding is, even though the order doesn't say this, my understanding is it wasn't in their initial filing. They didn't say we just have a 205 right, and so it's okay to subvert this anyway. It doesn't really matter, this timeline, because that only applies in a certain circumstance, but we just have a 205 right in any event.
The operative word is suggests.
Right. And so what the commission said is, but it doesn't really matter here because they didn't present anything to show that a change was needed anyway. So if it had been a 205, they wouldn't have met that. You still have to show something in a 205. You don't have to show that the old system is unjust and unreasonable, but you do have to show that what you're proposing is just and reasonable.
So if the proposal that was filed was to dispense with the elaborate notice requirement,
And
as a backup position, PJM is saying, and anyway, under the settlement order, there's a residual 205 right to file without regard to the notice. I'm not sure why rejection of the first makes it unnecessary to go on to the second.
Because it isn't, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I must not be explaining correctly. What the commission says is, given that we don't find the proposal just and reasonable, we're not going to address the argument that you could come in just under 205 without the four-month requirement because we wouldn't approve
it.
The
notice.
No, part of the proposal was to remove the notice. The other part of the proposal was to increase the cost of new entry by like 50%, 40 to 50%.
FERC didn't address that issue.
No, the commission did. In paragraph 29, that's what I was talking about before, again, apparently not explaining it clearly. While PJM suggests that a significant reliability concern motivates its filing, it doesn't provide any support for it. There's no support. On the one hand, PJM doesn't provide anything other than a blanket statement of we're having a reliability concern, cost of new entry has increased, and we need to increase it. And on the other hand, buyers came in this same proceeding and said, it's not true. There's no real increase here. Everything's working fine. The cost of new entry is within the equilibrium zone. The increase in the cost of...
We're getting clear. So this April 4 decision is a merits determination. It's not just a procedural.
I think it is. I think it is both, yes.
Okay.
And that's why the commission just didn't get to whether 205 has different requirements than this four-month requirement, because it just didn't need to here. I don't know what the commission would say about that. there are no further questions. I guess the final thing I would say is this is just quintessential commission expertise rate making. I mean, the commission made sure that this settlement would create the reliability.
You
that
mean other challenges that we've heard were not quintessential.
No,
this is really quintessential.
This is really
a good case.
This is really a situation where the commission, and it says it's very. I think it's very candid here. It says, for example, in the settlement order, J2647, paragraph 147. You know, no market system can guarantee success. But we think this one's going to work. And it says the same thing here. It says, in approving new rate designs, we rely on economic theory and evidence as to how we'll perform. And our economic theory and the evidence here shows that this will work. And again, that's in the first rehearing order at J2896, paragraph 191.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Paul Flynn for PJM Interconnection. First off, on the April 2008 order, I think the fairest reading of that is that what FERC said is that if you miss this deadline, maybe you can come in and still increase CONE, but you better have a darn good reason. And frankly, we didn't. We lost them at the get-go because our initial filing said, FERC, waive that deadline and allow us to come in with this large increase in the cost of new entry. And once FERC said, and we were past the deadline. I mean, we'd passed the deadline. Costs had gone up fairly substantially in a short period of time, so we got in as quick as we could, but we were after the deadline. And so the commission said, look, you've got to abide by the deadline. Now, we do have residual Section 205 rights. There is some question, though, whether or not FERC is going to allow you to exercise those rights in a case where you know, ECONE indicates no change and you haven't satisfied the procedural deadline without a very good reason, perhaps a reliability reason. They said, look, it's just not there. So I would read footnote 22 as saying essentially for the same reason that we aren't convinced that we should waive that other tariff provision on the deadline because you don't have a very good reason for doing it and that's not just unreasonable, I would read footnote 22 is saying also it's not just unreasonable to come in under this residual 205 right and change CONE there. That's probably the best reading of this order. Let me put it this way. If you were to come back to the commission timely, having followed that deadline, it would be an entirely different matter. You can't read this case for anything other than you can't take it outside the context of missing the deadline.
Can you offer an answer to me why a line on a graph.
I'd love to.
Is called.
I'd love to.
Demand curve. When it's
would you like to do
out of cost?
Variable resource requirement curve 101.
Yes.
Okay. Step back the way we used to do it a few years ago. The system planners would tell you what reserve margin above your expected peak load you should have in terms of total installed capacity. Okay. And then that's divvied up responsibility for providing that quantity of installed capacity is divvied up amongst all the people responsible for serving loads. If you miss that, if you don't provide that much capacity, you paid a penalty. The penalty was equal to the replacement cost of new capacity, which is adding a new peaking plant. It's the cost of new entry that we're using here. What's the innovation with RPM for a demand curve? Instead of having that fixed number where here's this fixed reserve margin and you have to meet that, and if you don't meet it, you pay a penalty based on that replacement cost, we've stretched that out. We've turned it, rather than a point, into a line, whereas the amount of capacity that is provided increases, the value of it diminishes. And by the same token, if you are short...
Let me put it a slightly different way. Inherently, this seems great logic to the idea mm-hmm. that it is the market clearing price of new entry, cost of new entry, that should be determinative. That is to say, that's intuitively appealing if you have a an ordinary demand curve mm-hmm. and an ordinary supply curve. But whatever you have there that's VVR or demand, it's not a demand curve, right?
Well, because there, you can't quantify. What's the demand for a reliable system? It's a public good. You can't, there's, no one would want to shoulder it because there's...
So I thought demand would be derived from customers' demand, and then one would have to...
It is. What you're doing here is you're taking the expected peak load on the system, okay, you're increasing it by a reserve margin, and you're saying we need to procure that quantity of installed capacity to make sure that we have reliable service.
That's the quantity aspect of the
yes.
demand, but not the price aspect of demand.
And the price, implicitly, even under the old system, was correlated with the replacement cost of a new generator. And so we are simply taking the old system, which said this is the quantity that you must procure, and making it more sophisticated to recognize that. The old system said if you get past the reserve margin, capacity has no value whatsoever. And that led to all sorts of problems. And so this recognizes that there is some value to capacity to the region above and beyond that fixed reserve margin. That's the theory behind the variable resource requirement curve. So it is a demand in the sense that, I mean, before it was the system planners telling you how much capacity you had to procure. That's the proxy for demand in a situation where we're not talking about the daily energy market. We're talking about how much must be installed to ensure a reliable system. There may come a day when prices in the energy market and the spot market can be allowed to drift so high that would be the determinant of the value of a reliable system. But for many, many reasons, we're not there yet, so you have this construct that depends upon a system planning determination of what's the target, what do you need to get. That's why you have a proxy. Now, as to Judge Edwards' question about whether this is the cost of new entry, every offer submitted in the supply curve reflects the developer's perception of what the cost of new entry is. They have to anticipate how much revenue they'll get on the energy market and the ancillary services market, guesstimate what it costs to build one of these peaking plants, and then make their judgment. FERC conceivably could devise a program that took into account offers above the demand curve. The tricky bit with that approach is once you get past that determination of this just and reasonable, this is what the region needs, what's your criteria for determining whether those sorts of offers are in the ballpark or not? What's acceptable? And that's a tough nut to crack. And FERC wasn't satisfied with PSEG's suggestion that, oh, just let the market monitor do it. Because that vests too much discretion in a single individual. That administrative approach vests too much discretion in a single individual to make the ultimate determination of something that was supposed to be an automated, empirical, formulaic procedure. You can't just say, well, we'll leave it to Joe to tell us what it should be. And so FERC was well within its bounds to say, look, we're going to go with what we have, which is this demand curve that we've determined is a just and reasonable determination of the quantity of capacity that should be procured for the region in order to assure long-term reliability. They were well within their rights to make that determination. So there were, as I saw PSEG's brief, there were two essential points. One was that the current ECOM doesn't consider unclear new entry offers, and the other is it just takes too long to make changes. As I said, the unclear new entry offers, I just explained, they perhaps could have done that, but they weren't satisfied that there was enough, that the particular approach that PSEG suggested was workable. As to taking too long, of course, if we discussed, there is in our back pockets the ability to make a 205 change, but even beyond that, as FERC observed, there's value to price stability. After all, we're talking about a capital cost intensive additions to generating capacity, whereas auction clearing prices could just jump around from year to year. And if you adjusted CONE every year, the CONE you're going to use to clear that auction every year, just based on a single year's price gyrations.
Actually, that's an interesting question. Why would the market clearing, price jump around from year to year?
You're a developer, and you've got two considerations. You're considering not only those fixed costs of building, operating, maintaining this new peaking plant, you've also got to guess how much revenue you're going to get from the energy market and the other markets that PJM administers. Capacity is designed to fill the gap, the dollar gap, to make sure that there's enough dollars coming in to ensure that I'll build that installed capacity, even if I can't get enough money in the energy market or the ancillary services market. So the expectations about what those energy revenues could be could jump all over the place because those energy revenues jump all over the place from year to year. If you base your adjustment on market clearing prices, you have to judge, you know, how much of that movement is transient noise and how much of it is meaningful trend. And, you know, as Professor Hobbs said, you know, there can be changes, you know, slow changes in technology over time. Perhaps instead of a combustion turbine being the most efficient, a combined cycle is the most efficient, and that'll be a whole different set of costs to base this on. But that's not going to happen overnight. And once you accept that it's okay, there's some value to having a dampening mechanism in between those raw auction prices and the annual adjustments to the VRR curve, well, then you're just arguing over the degree of how much of a dampening mechanism there should be, and then you're right on FERC's turf, and you've got to give them a fair amount of deference on that.
Mr. Flynn, thank you.
Thank you.
2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. FERC's claim that the ECONE mechanism would reduce volatility is actually not correct. ECONE is likely to increase volatility in RPM markets because it will send incorrect price signals for numerous years. There will be a delay of new entry until there are more shortage conditions. Then there will be an excess of supply, and prices would actually
trading
be expected to be more volatile.
In one dimension versus volatility in another. Price as opposed to quantity. Right?
Well, whenever there's a shortage, that's when prices go higher. So through an incorrect, through poor price signals, you will end up with shortages and more, and you will get more volatile prices. FERC never did explain why existing bids by existing generating units should be part of this mechanism. And logically, I just can't see it. As far as the issue about the Section 205 rights, if we didn't have any ECONE at all, the administrative method would probably be okay. The problem is that when the administrative method is saying to do one thing and the ECONE method is saying to do something else, FERC is faced with policy choices or a whole bunch of criteria that it then needs to decide what the cone value should be, whereas the design of the model was that the cone value should always reflect the cost of new entry. I see my time is up. If you have any questions, thank you.
Case is submitted.